You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Maloney, and I am Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. It is a pleasure to welcome you today to the 15th Raymond Aron Lecture. This lecture series was launched in 2004, and it is named after Raymond Aron, a renowned 20th century French political scientist, philosopher, and great friend of the United States. I'd first like to take a moment to thank our partners. We're very grateful to the Embassy of France for their collaboration and support over the years, and I particularly want to recognize Ambassador Philippe Etienne, who is here with us virtually today and who will offer remarks shortly. I also want to thank the French Foreign Ministry, and in particular, the policy planning team, led by Manuel Lafont-Rapnui. In recent months, the necessity of transatlantic cooperation on urgent global issues has become more clear than ever. To fight the coronavirus pandemic, the United States and European countries have taken unprecedented measures to protect the lives of their citizens, including mandating stringent lockdowns and severely curtailing international travel. These measures have devastated American and European economies alike. Today, it is our distinct pleasure to host Dr. Laurence Boone, a devoted advocate of international cooperation, to discuss how to rehabilitate our transatlantic economies after COVID-19. Dr. Boone is the chief economist at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Before joining the OECD, Dr. Boone was chief economist at AXA, and prior to that, she served as an economic advisor to French President Hollande. We are honored that she will offer her perspective on the challenges and opportunities generated by the current crisis. We're also honored to be joined this morning by Harvard University professor Jason Furman, who will offer a response to Dr. Boone. Professor Furman served for 8 years as the top economic advisor to President Obama, including as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He's now a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, in addition to teaching at Harvard. And last but not least, our own Doug Redeker, a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings, will moderate the conversation. Doug is the founding partner of International Capital Strategies, LLC, and previously represented the United States on the executive board of the International Monetary Fund. In a few short moments, Laurence Boone will deliver her lecture from this year's virtual stage. But first, I'd like to turn it over to French Ambassador Philippe Etienne for brief remarks. Once again, thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Suzanne. And good morning, good afternoon, everybody. I am extremely honored to take part in such a high quality event and to say a few words before Laurence and Jason. The Raymond Aron Lecture has been the flagship event of the embassy's longstanding partnership with Brookings since its launch in 2004. The lecture series, as you said, Suzanne, is named in honor of a great Frenchman, Raymond Aron, a philosopher, a historian, a sociologist, also a journalist, and a committed transatlanticist. He was always a critic of anti-Americanism in France. And today he would no doubt highlight, as he did all his life, the importance of continued transatlantic cooperation on the crisis our countries, our economies, our democracies are facing. Over the years, the Raymond Aron Lecture has become a prominent forum bringing together French and American scholars to speak about critical issues affecting the transatlantic relationship. Past speakers have included Pierre Asner, Thérèse Delpech, and Justice Stephen Breyer. We will be discussing a crucial topic today. 2020 has been plagued by the COVID-19 pandemic, which is disrupting our lives on every level. It has led officials on both sides of the Atlantic to take unprecedented measures to protect their populations and restart their economies. This recovery effort, which France has championed also within the European Union, must also be transatlantic in nature and contribute to a new quality in the long-standing ties between Europe and the United States. More than ever, while the pandemic is keeping us apart, France is committed to supporting institutions dedicated to the vigorous exchange of ideas, and Brookings is an exemplary place for intellectual debate. We are honored today to be joined by two distinguished economists, Laurence Boone and Jason Furman. I am delighted to launch the first virtual edition of our lecture series today, and I look forward to the conversation. Dr. Boone, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Suzanne, and thank you, Philippe. It's a pleasure to be here with you, even so it would be a lot better if that was taking place physically in Washington. But I'm very honored and very happy to discuss this lecture with Jason Furman as well. And it's a very difficult time now, so the focus of the lecture will really be about what's waiting ahead of us, what challenges for our economies on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think none of us has a ready solution, but hopefully the two of our two economies and Jason and me today can help think about these challenges. So let me share my screen now and get into the presentation. Okay, so I will just start by quickly offering you our projections, which were published last week, and then I will move into the next into what's ahead of us for the next 12 to 18 months at a more granular level. What you can see here is our set of projections, and what they reflect is really how uncertain the outlook is, because we don't know the pace at which the virus will continue to spread across various countries or when a vaccine or treatment may be available. What we do know is that it's unlikely that we have any widespread vaccine or treatment for the next 12 to 18 months, so that the period until end 2021 will be one where we will have to live with the virus. So that's the first thing. The second thing is this is long. It will change and affect our economies in a way that we haven't seen yet. And I will discuss some of the challenges that this is creating. What you can see here is that every single country of the world except China will be in a very, very deep recession this year. And by the end of next year, because the virus is still with us, then not many of them will not have recovered the type of economic activity they had in 2019. So let me, now that I've brushed this very quickly, and just a note on this before moving to the next slide, which is this US projection include a fiscal stimulus that we were expecting at the time, which was the projection, and which now looks very unlikely, so that the number you see for 2021 is likely to be much below that 4%. Now, one other thing before I dig into the specific of the presentation on which I wanted to say what is the mirror image of uncertainty is really the lack of confidence. And we may think that after the first phase of the crisis, where there was some sort of simultaneous confinement across OECD countries, including in the US and Europe, now that things are reopening and we have seen the beginning of some sort of V-shaped recovery for the sectors that can function normally, people would start living as they were before. But what this chart reminds us really is the amazing lack of confidence that is affecting households across countries. And as you can see from here, between 30 and 70% of people are still avoiding to go out in general. And that's still the case in mid-August. And it doesn't deepen so much if you look at Korea on the right-hand side on how they were affected by the virus. And this lack of confidence for people and the uncertainty that we have, we really mean that it's going to be that the effect of the virus on our behavior, on business behavior, will be long-lasting and profound. And the other thing, which I think is super important, is when we're faced with such uncertainty and lack of confidence, everything that policymakers can do to increase some confidence, to provide some certainty, will be helpful. And they cannot obviously eliminate the virus story, but what they can do is provide a framework, a clear and transparent framework for policy, how they think about it, and how they will have it evolve with the evolution of the virus and also of the economic situation. And that institutional solidity and robustness will be very much key in the months to come. So what type of shocks are we facing? So you have the impact effect of the confinement measure, which is the red line going down. And now we are at the beginning of the three blue arrows. Also, obviously, we don't know which one will be the prevailing one. If the health situation is short-lived and we can recover quickly, then we may have the V-shaped recovery, so it looks less and less likely. But the longer it lasts and the more difficult the situation becomes, and I would argue the tougher the demand shock, the larger the demand shock we're facing, and the slower will be the recovery, the tougher or the more important the scarring effect. And that is taking place, sorry, I should have put that here. What you can see here is what we were saying about the scarring effect. And actually, there's a word on which I wanted to insist, which is reallocation. And I'll come back to this because we have here both a demand and a supply shock, and they need two policy treatments on which I will spend a second in a minute. So, Before I move on policy, I would like also to put that into context, and we may have forgotten it because it looks now softer with the benefit of insight and once we've gone through COVID. But before this shock, all was not going very well. We had trend growth going down because there was less technology diffusion, because capital deepening was hampered by very high uncertainty, not only on the trade technology tensions, but there was also the high level of corporate debt. There was also some slowdown in the diffusion, the reallocation of business, and we did the diffusion of technology, which is what you can see on the right hand side chart. So much less job reallocation that we used to see, very much lower entry rates for firms and exit rates. And that Jason has discussed this extensively, is partly due to reduced competition due to the digital technology. It may also be due to insolvency regimes, which are increasingly punishing failure and inhibiting corporate restructuring, and also easy money, so to speak, that was keeping some of the very low productivity firms alive. All that to say that when we will discuss reallocation, it was already slowing before the crisis, and we're having this shock now, which may make it even more of a challenge. So we have an aggregate shock, which is the compression in GDP growth, which is very big, and we're going to have a reallocation shock in this setup where reallocation is tough. Now, what do we do with that? I think the first thing, and on which I would really like to insist, is that just don't do no harm. And don't repeat the mistake of the past. What you can see with these two charts is the fiscal tightening that took place far too early in the wake of the financial crisis on both sides of the Atlantic. At least on this, we made similar mistakes. So the blue bar are showing how fiscal policy is getting tighter in 2010, 2011, and until 2013, both in Europe and in the US. And what you can see conversely is how the gap between observed growth and trend growth is widening on the left-hand side when austerity is setting up in the Eurozone. And it's this growth is stalling on the right-hand side when austerity is taking place in the US. And the main difference between the two at the time was a very generous monetary policy in the US and a much less generous one at this stage and until the beginning of 2015 in Europe. So, but this really shows that if we don't have the right macro policy in terms of fiscal and monetary support, then we can do a lot of harm to the very fragile situation that we have now. So I think the first thing to repeat and repeat is just to keep fiscal policy support going on. Now, the second thing I would like to insist on for the macro level and which has to do with the supporting demand is what we can fear in terms of firms and jobs outlook if we don't keep some support going on. What these two charts show is in previous recessions, so in the early 90s and in the financial crisis, how bankruptcies and unemployment has evolved. And the main takeaway from this is that it takes a while usually before bankruptcy or unemployment rate shoot up, and then it takes a very long time for them to come down. And the longer and the more scarring effects they are. Here on the left-hand side, it's US bankruptcies filing in the two previous recession, and you can see that it takes between 1 to 2 years after the beginning of the recession for them to start going up. I think in this juncture, it may be different because there's been a lot of corporate support. But what that also tells us, if this support is withdrawn prematurely or too largely, then we're going to see some wave of bankruptcies, and that runs a big, big risk for not only the economy, but also the jobs, which is represented on the right-hand side. And I think there are two interesting things on these charts. One is, you know, how reactive the US economy is compared to Europe, where you can see unemployment going up very rapidly and then coming down more forcefully. And I'm sure Jason will have a lot to say about this. Obviously, the situation this time is a bit different because we had a lot of support for unemployed people from the trough of the recession. So as a kind of automatic stabilizer, even if it wasn't one. And in Europe, the same, it's usually slower to pick up, but then it takes longer to go down. So the lesson from this really is we thought the confinement and containment phase was tough, but the most challenging period is ahead of us, because now blanket support will be more difficult warranted, and if we withdraw this support, then we will see bankruptcies and job losses unfolding. So there's a big aggregate shock, which I was describing. Sorry, my light is going on because I'm not moving. And there is a reallocation on which I would like to spend a minute here. So the left-hand side shows the big shock across sectors. And what the right-hand side helped to show is which sector are actually being affected by COVID-related measure. And you know those sectors, but the point I want to make here is that they represent between 13 and 20% of total employment in OECD country, which is very big. And we don't know whether all of these sectors will be permanently smaller, but what we do know is that for the next year, perhaps a couple of years, they will operate at subpar dynamism, and some of them will change, probably like transportation, whereas others like food services or accommodation may remain very much the same. If we look at the US more specifically, then there's some analysis by Barrero and other authors who show that they estimate that between 30 to 42% of some job lost during the pandemic may be permanently gone. But I think what is even more interesting is they estimate that the rate of reallocation is about the same size. One other thing which is runs the risk of affecting this reallocation is obviously that not everybody or not every profession over the capacity to telework. So I think we have this aggregate shock. We also have this reallocation shock. And that's a reallocation shock that's much bigger than anything we have seen. It's probably even bigger than what the energy transition will require. So faced with this, what most countries have done as a first policy move was to support income. And I won't dwell very much on the differences between Europe and the US, because even if the mechanism is different, at the end of the day, the objective was very similar: to support labor income. So in the first phase of the crisis, when there is containment, this, I would say, the same care was being taken of people on both sides of the Atlantic. But what is perhaps more interesting and more challenging is what will happen when we have to go through the reallocation, because the job retention scheme is it's tying the worker with the firms much more strongly than the furlough scheme that we have seen in the US. So in principle, if we have a temporary shock, then the job retention scheme will be super efficient. For example, we close everything down for 3 months and we reopen in exactly the same way. And let's assume there's no stronger demand shock, the economy recover, then the economy can resume as it was before. On the other hand, if we have a shock, and I think that's what we believe in, which will last 1 year, perhaps two, when there will be profound changes on the economy, across sectors, on the way people work, then this job retention scheme can actually become a hindrance to reallocation, because it's much more difficult for a worker to actually move some secure position, being sure of getting an income, and to go into another sector, taking the risk of, you know, having a probation period that doesn't work, with some perhaps difficulties and challenges in taking up this job, than staying into a job where you're sure to have a pay from the government and being protected for 1 or 2 years. But if we do believe that the economy will change, at the same time, those changes will take longer to materialize. They will have a dampening effect on trend growth, and they will likely leave some workers behind without the skills, without the retraining, or without the experience to actually change sector. And I would like to give you an example of this for a category of the population, which is actually the young people and the recently graduating people. What you see on the left-hand side here is how much people are lagging behind when they enter the job market into a recession. And what this chart on the left-hand side shows is that usually not only it's more difficult to get a job, but it's less well paid. And it takes on average about 10 years for people who graduated and entered the job market into a recession to catch up compared to what they would have achieved if they had joined the labor market at a normal time. Partly this reflects the fact that recession damage work firm quality, and young people are more likely to join firms which are less productive, which is why we show the chart on the right-hand side. But partly and as people, you know, change jobs, then they renew with this, but it's much more difficult for them. So what can we do about this? In fact, I'd like us to have all the answers, but I don't think that's the case. I think one first thing to do is to actually gradually align the replacement rate of job retention schemes or special schemes as in the US on unemployment benefits, so that there's no arbitrage between staying in job and looking for a job. But that would be a bit tough if we were sticking with that. So I think what's important as well, and we are currently discussing this at the OECD, and I'm sure, Jason, we have a lot to say about this. Another thing is to try and link some of this job retention scheme with a lot more flexibility than we usually have. So allow people in these schemes to take part-time job elsewhere, to accumulate the income and experience so that at some stage they can change job. Allow these schemes or link these schemes, make them compulsory on training. Also, we must say that training as it is usually badly designed and targeted. So there's a real job to do here if we want this to be efficient. And that is also a way of inducing some reallocation without putting the income of people at risk. And I think another one is to also make the firms pay a lot more for this job retention scheme. I fear I've talked too much already, so let me just conclude with this. I think also what's super important is to make sure that we remove some of the regulation that are actually hampering both job reallocation and also the firm dynamic. The left-hand side is showing actually the effect of the multiplicity of occupational licenses that we have seen in the US across states, sometimes for jobs like selling flowers. And obviously, if you need a license in one state where there's a lot of demand for that, then it's slowing down your impetus to go there. And the other thing, and I think, again, I just want to mention competition due to digital policy and to digital technology, and how it's been hampered. But I think Jason will have a lot more to say about this, and I don't want to spoil his primer on this. So sorry, Doug, for having been too long. Thank you. And I hope I didn't miss anything of interest.
Thank you, Laurence. That was fabulous. A great introduction. I'm going to introduce a man for whom there is no need for an introduction, even though Suzanne already gave him one. Jason, your counterpoint, perhaps, to Laurence, before we get into some discussion and then some questions. Jason?
Great. So honored to be here. What a wonderful reminder about how lucky the world is that Laurence is the chief economist of the OECD. Just what a wonderfully suited person to that job, to the transatlantic dialogue. And insofar as there are any problems in the world economy, it's either because of COVID or because people don't listen to every single thing and do every single thing that Laurence says. As she talked, I was listening and I heard demand, I heard competition, I heard get rid of regulations that get in the way of competition. I heard about the pre-existing challenges and problems with dynamism in our economies. I heard about the longer term scarring effects that this has. I heard about the different paths that we could go on depending on our policy. I agree with every one of those. And I think all of those are important points. I'm going to just give a brief set of comments on a few things, some of which are related to, hopefully all of which are related to what Laurence was talking about. I wanted to start with the unemployment rate changes. You hear this a lot, especially in the United States. The unemployment rate in the United States has risen a lot more than the unemployment rate in any of the other OECD countries. These data at a time like this, though, are very misleading. The issue is, if you're furloughed from your job, you're temporarily not working in the United States, you're classified as unemployed. If you're furloughed from your job in Europe, you are probably classified as employed. The reason is, in the United States, you're getting a check from the government. In Europe, the employer gets a check from the government, and then the employer writes you a check. If you take the furloughed people out of the US data, you get a number more like this, pretty comparable to the types of numbers you see in other OECD countries. That shouldn't be a surprise because, as we saw in Laurence's projections, the declines in output are similar across countries, which means the decline in work is similar across countries. What differs is the form that decline takes and its classification. So that raises a really, what I think is a most interesting transatlantic policy issue we're dealing with right now, where you have very different models for dealing at least very different superficially. We'll talk about how different they are models for dealing with the employment situation in Europe and in the United States. As we all know, and as Laurent said, in Europe, in the United States, workers are furloughed and they get a check from the government. Those checks used to be more than 100%. Now they're about 50%. Then in Europe, if you're furloughed, you get a check from your business, sometimes less than 100%. And then the business is reimbursed by the government, again, sometimes less than 100%. In the US papers, there have been articles saying that the United States is choosing mass unemployment. That this is a choice and that this was a huge policy mistake. I think that argument was mistaken. The fact that the unemployment rate in the United States has come from 15% down to 8%, it's still incredibly high, consistent with the large reduction in output, but it's not, but we have seen people on temporary layoffs being recalled to their jobs. I think there's actually, as Laurent said, a lot of commonalities between these two systems. In both cases, if you're not working, you're compensated. In both cases, the employers shed the cost, which is important because you want the employers to make it through this, be there at the other end so they can reopen and employ people. In both systems, if an employer returns to economic viability, they can reactivate their employees. The job match in the United States is not severed by a furlough. The furlough means the person continues to be listed by the employer. They continue to be in the computer system. It's just that their hours are reduced to zero, their wages are reduced to zero, and they have to file with the government. But they can be reactivated very easily. Conversely, in Europe, you can have all the job retention schemes you want, but if at the end of them there's no viable employer, there's not going to be an employee. There are some advantages and disadvantages of the two approaches. The U.S. approach can be a little bit lower cost for employers because they fully shed the obligation. The European approach is less disruptive to employees. In the United States, it was unnecessarily disruptive given the administrative underfunding and in some states, the deliberate obstacles that were created over the years to make it harder for people to get unemployment insurance. The U.S. actually gives employees a little bit more leverage to refuse to return to work. It's not complete leverage. If you refuse to return to work, your employer can effectively report you to the state and you'll stop getting your unemployment insurance. But some employers are reluctant to do that. Some states are reluctant to stop it. So as an employee, if you feel your job is unsafe, you don't want to go back to it. In the United States, you actually have more ability to say no about going back to your job than you do in Europe. In Europe, you're getting a check from your employer. They basically can make you go back when they're ready to. Finally, and this is probably perhaps the most important, there's a big debate about how much what we're seeing is this, what I call stop-start shock, where a business stops and a business reopens, versus how much is reallocation. A restaurant goes out of business, people need to find a new restaurant. Or people go to movie theaters less, and so people who work in movie theaters need to find jobs in other areas. The U.S. approach, by being based at the individual level, is better at allocation. The European approach might be better at job attachment. I'm a little bit skeptical of that, but we'll see. The bottom line is I would give a slight edge to the U.S. approach. But I'm very curious to see how it turns out over time. You can't judge it from the headline unemployment rates. You have to ask the question, you know, something like next year. There'll be a huge amount to be learned by these two differences. And I think the OECD and Laurence will hopefully help us do the learning and share the learning. Now let me switch to on reallocation. You know, we don't have great policies to deal with reallocation. You know, we can do search assistance, we can do job training, we can do dislocated worker programs. I'm all for those. I'd put more money into them. I just wouldn't count on them. I wouldn't count on them being a large scale change in employment. And in fact, if we count on them too much, we won't do the one thing we know we can do, which is shift demand And in particular, that's especially fiscal policy, but there may be some additional scope for monetary policy. That's old-fashioned, it's crude, it's not tailored at the current situation, but we know it works. All the fancier things we're less sure about. Let me now just do a quick whirlwind thing. There is broad agreement that we can afford stimulus now. Janet Yellen thinks it, Greg Mankiw thinks it, and most importantly, Laurence Boone thinks it as well. The bigger debate is about the medium-term fiscal situation. And you cannot be a part of that debate if you haven't internalized this picture. This picture doesn't tell us the exact answer, but this picture is profoundly important. It shows that interest rates have fallen. They've fallen across a range of countries. They've fallen for a long time. This isn't caused by the financial crisis. This isn't caused by COVID. This isn't caused by some lunatic central banker. This is some underlying structural facts about the economy that I think are very likely to be persistent. Debt has gone up. We're going to have debt to GDP above 100% of GDP in the United States, Italy, Japan, and France this year. So debt is increasing everywhere, but something really interesting is happening. Even as the debt goes up in the United States, each year it'll be higher than the last, interest payments on the debt are going down each year. Each year they're lower than the past in nominal terms. In fact, the better way to think about the fiscal capacity of the country isn't debt to GDP, which has all sorts of flaws as a measure. Debt is a stock. You can pay it back over time. GDP is the amount of income you have in 1 year. You don't need to use that year's income to pay your debt. You can use it over many, many years. And debt to GDP doesn't tell you that the level of debt is very different if you're paying a high interest rate than if you're paying a low interest rate. This is what government debt service looks like as a share of the economy, and it's come down everywhere over time and is relatively low in historical perspective. And so that's why we have a lot of fiscal capacity right now. That's why I don't think we need to be worried in the medium term. This slide is just here to intimidate and scare you. I don't have time to talk about it, but the bottom line of this slide is that there are different levels of deficits you can have in order to stabilize your debt. If you want to stabilize your debt at 75% of GDP, then France is already very close to doing that, and the UK is already all the way there. If you want to stabilize your debt at 250% of GDP, the United States has a little bit of work to get to a goal like that. So there's these different debt goals. Countries are in different places. Everywhere, I think, is roughly within range of one of these goals or needs to make a relatively modest adjustment to make it to one of these goals. The bigger question, though, is do you want to stabilize the debt at 75% of GDP? At 150% of GDP, at 250% of GDP, or another number. And I'll conclude by giving you the definitive answer to that question. I don't know. I don't think any economists know. I've asked all of them. No one's given me a very good answer. Until somebody gives me an answer, my answer for the United States is that it should be 150%. That would require a small fiscal adjustment to hit that target. My answer for Europe is some number that's higher than the 60% that was set in Maastricht, which was ages and ages ago in a world of much, much higher interest rates, probably below the 150% that I'm comfortable with for the United States. Trying to figure that out is going to be really important over the medium term. The short term, we don't need to know the answer to that question to know that, as Laurence said, we need a lot more aggregate demand. Thanks so much.
Jason, thank you. And Laurence, I think the world is a safer, better, healthier place, not only because of Laurence, but also because, Jason, you've spent your career in the public policy arena. Excellent presentation. You actually give me a great opportunity to pick up on some of the US-EU differences and similarities. And hopefully you and Laurence can kind of explore that. I am curious if that last visual is your avatar on your social media, because I think that that actually would be suitable to you. But that's different for those who are not social media junkies. Let me just say for the audience, we're going to spend about 15 or 20 minutes talking amongst ourselves. There are two means by which you can forward questions to us that we'll hopefully be able to get to. One is through Twitter with the hashtag AronLecture, and the other is by email to events@brookings.edu. So if you've got any questions, please send them that way and we'll try and get to them. But Laurence and Jason, let me just start and pick up on your comparisons there, Jason. So assume Laurence is right, and I think that the theory that she posited is we won't have an effective, widely distributed vaccine in the immediate future, and we may be looking at 2021, where there is a continuation of the current ambiguous health response at best. Which of the two systems, the economic and social models of the EU and the US, is going to be more resilient overall if there's a second wave and if there is no vaccine that is going to put this to bed immediately? Just more broadly, which of the two social and economic systems is a more resilient system moving forward in that scenario? Jason, you want to start and then Laurence?
So I think both systems are capable of doing better and both systems are capable of doing worse. In fact, the United States has managed to do both of those in the last 6 months. It was doing a good job in the economic response 6 months ago with the CARES Act, which was really large, really fast. You know, it wasn't perfect, but it was impressive. And now we're doing an awful job with no fiscal response at all. And so I think those dials within the systems are much more important than the differences between the systems. I think the European fiscal response started out a bit smaller than the United States. I think maybe a bit smaller than it should have been, but there's been, you know, more follow through.
Laurence?
Yeah. So, I want to thank Jason for a really nice and interesting presentation. And second, I think I'm sorry to say, but I think I have to agree with Jason that I don't think you can talk about what's best and worst. If I had to say one additional thing is the European system is providing some kind of certainty. And in this world where you don't really know where we're heading, knowing that there will be some support and it's not totally erratic, and you know, it gives you it should help lower precautionary saving and give people more confidence that they can change job. But I think in either case, it's very important to keep the income support throughout this episode. And actually not to to be a little more balanced, let me rebound on one of the things that Jason was alluding to, was mentioning, which is the debt. We may have more certainty on job retention scheme in Europe compared to the US, so that, you know, you will be protected by the state. But there is always this threat in Europe that there will be a change in the European fiscal framework with the risk of too early austerity. And I hope that, you know, Europe was quick for once to suspend the rules of Maastricht, and I hope they will take the time to think about any other rule so as not to repeat the mistake that we had before. So the uncertainty in Europe is more the magnitude of the fiscal support, and I guess in the US on the stop and go fiscal support.
So let me ask you more of a provocative question here. What do you make of the argument that the U.S. economy is inherently more sustainable because there's a greater willingness to accept more negative social outcomes in the U.S. than would be tolerated in Europe? Even in your more hawkish, frugal countries, there is a basic acceptance, a basic expectation of social provisions from the government in Europe. In the U.S., that's just not a really widely accepted model. There is an argument I've heard that makes the U.S. economy more commercially oriented, obviously less socially beneficial, but that makes the U.S. economy more long-term resilient. Do you buy that argument?
Me or Jason?
We'll start with you, Laurence, and then Jason.
Okay, I don't think I surprise you very much if I say I don't fully agree with this argument. Actually, sustainability for me includes something that's socially sustainable as well. And we have seen over the past two decades how widening inequality have actually undermining the foundation of sustainable growth, because it leads people to be against openness and globalization. It leads them to fear technical progress, and it leads them to, in fact, rebuke competition as well. So everything that helps lift growth is put into question in that cases, and sometimes rightly so, because, you know, technology has destroyed some jobs and displaced some people, and the same for globalization. So I think the social support that can be brought to buffer the shock of globalization and technology diffusion, even if overall on aggregate it has been good, is actually welcome. But I think where Europe has a lot more to do is the form of this social support cannot only be income redistribution. It has to be it has to give an equal access to opportunities. And on this, I'm not sure the two models differ so much, unfortunately.
Jason, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think if you don't have good social support, it makes it harder for people to take risks. It makes them, locks them into their jobs. There is macro evidence that economists Berg, Oster, and Zettelmeyer at the IMF a decade ago found that greater inequality led to greater economic instability. Some people like Raghu Rajan have tied the borrowing and the run-up to the financial crisis being a symptom of inequality and contributing to that crisis, and maybe more importantly to the difficulty of getting out of it. So I think there's a lot of ways in which lack of inclusion actually hurt economic resilience. What I think might be the case, Laurence and the projection she showed had a smaller GDP contraction in the United States than in most European countries, smaller in the United States than Germany, for example. I have a hypothesis about that. I don't know at all if it's true, or speculation. Speculation is the better word, which is that we've been a little bit more resistant to the virus itself. Not resistant health-wise. We get affected by it like anyone else, and we take fewer precautions, and thus more Americans are getting it. And the caseload is higher here. But that we shut down a little bit less in response to it. And as a result, you know, the virus, everything else being equal, is bad for your economy. The more virus you have, the worse your economy will be. But the more worried you are about the virus, the worse your economy will be too. And so the United States has a lot of virus, but is sort of willing to have it, and thus has a surprising amount of economic activity given the extent of the disease, whereas in a country like Germany, economic activity is more constrained. As I said, that's very speculative. It doesn't line up with the numbers Laurence showed us from the survey of confidence of people across countries, but I think that's an interesting question to explore. It would also explain why states with a lot of virus have done economically no worse than states in the Northeast that have been much more successful in containing the virus.
Well, certainly, and not the subject of today's conversation, at least not right now, but the financial markets in the U.S. would certainly bear some of that out, given the divergence of some of the virus impact and the health of the U.S. equity markets. But let me move on to a different question here. How do you see the COVID crisis response impacting gender inequality? Now, the U.S. already suffers from less generous childcare benefits and system than in Europe, which one could argue depresses female labor force participation. Will this crisis make things worse? Let's stick with you, Jason, if you don't mind, then we'll go to Laurence.
Yeah, I mean, this is a crisis, the first one that has affected women more than it's affected men in the labor market. And you see it in lots of different ways. You know, people have looked at economists writing papers, and you know, the productivity of female economists has gone down more than the output of female economists has gone down more than the output of male economists. And it's because presumably they're spending more time on childcare and work at home. So not that their output per hour went down, the number of hours. And that this hit a country without a paid leave system and without mandatory sick days is just reveals a huge hole in our social safety net. And I hope filling it is a top priority going forward.
Ross?
Yeah, I think I hope it's not boring, but I have to agree with Jason as well on this question. One thing to add is also that a lot of essential workers are actually women, the ones that are exposed to safety risks, you know, in supermarkets or in less skilled jobs, in hospital, home nurses, and elderly care activities. So not only they tend to be penalized at home because they have to take care of the kids, but they also are very much exposed to safety issues. So yeah, that I think is also weighing on gender inequality. And if you look at the larger part of the world, given it's also more difficult for emerging markets to cope with the virus, and given the large share of informal work that they have, it's usually women are even more penalized in this area of the world.
So let me stick with the gender issue, but move down to the children. Child care is one thing, but American kids have, I believe, been less likely to go back to school in most instances than have European children. If that trend continues and the population of U.S. school-age kids is disproportionately impacted by not attending school full-time, in-person, the way their European peers are, do you think that there's a longer-term impact that American kids, American students actually fall behind in a globally competitive landscape, that American kids just simply lose some fraction of a year of their education and they never get it back?
So to me, there are two things, and I'm sure Jason will complete, but one of the things is effectively that a share of the population that's usually less well off than others struggle more with homeschooling, and their parents are less able to help them. They have usually not the IT equipment to do it. And the OECD has published something, I think, a couple of weeks ago to actually measure the impact it may have on long-term growth. Which you may have a look at. It can be, if my memory is good, about 1.5% of GDP, which is a lot. But more importantly, I think it's also something that may have profound effect, in the sense that if you have a share of population that's less skilled, and still there will be a share of population very well educated and super intelligent and functioning, then the technological disruption may be even more important than what it would be otherwise. So that wouldn't be in the comparison with US and Europe, because there is the social cost of work in Europe to take into account. But what I'm afraid is that the hollowing out of some workers that we've seen with technology diffusion may be accentuated with the fact that a generation of people, or part of a generation of people, may lose some skills.
Jason, let me throw it over to you, but let me also throw on an add-on question, which is, do you think that the concept of automatic stabilizers, which is prevalent across Europe but not so much here in the U.S., that this crisis has shifted that dynamic so that the longer-term use of automatic stabilizers in the U.S. economy is something that is more likely to continue, or are we going to go back to ad hoc response to crises as they develop in the future?
I hope the answer to your question is no, we will not go back to ad hoc response. And we're in a better place than we've been in my economic policy involved life to have improved automatic stabilizers. Just in brief, if your country has higher taxes as a share of GDP, higher spending as a share of GDP, a more progressive fiscal system, then when a shock hits, you're going to have a larger fiscal response, even with no law passed. The United States has a smaller government and a less progressive government. As a result, it has very weak automatic stabilizers. We could make the government much bigger and more progressive. There are aspects of that I'd be in favor of. But there is a simpler, more technocratic, wonky solution, which is you put in place formulas, things like when the unemployment rate is above 8%, automatically, you know, you get more unemployment, or you get a check, or you get extra nutritional assistance, or you get a bigger tax cut, you know, whatever it is, you put that in, you put the triggers in. Some of that was included in the HEROES Act that passed the House. Even more of it was included in other legislation supported by various members of the House and the Senate. And, you know, it's something that is not going to be on the menu for if something happens this month, and something happening this month or early next month is very unlikely. But I think it's much higher on the agenda in certain configurations next year than it has been for a while.
Laurence, so I asked Jason about the U.S. automatic stabilizer possibility of continuing in the future. Let me go back to Europe. And one of the major European responses has been the creation of the recovery fund and all of the dynamics around a common European borrowing instrument for the first time in any sort of meaningful size. What is your view on the recovery fund and the issues around it? Is it the precursors of a Hamiltonian moment, or is it actually, as some critics would suggest, a one-off, it's not going to go anywhere, and let's move on? You think it's got legs?
I think it does got legs. I mean, it's fantastic, right? We've throughout the financial crisis, I think since the creation of not only the euro, but since the first time countries started discussing the European Union and community and this issue of fiscal and common fiscal and monetary policy, Europe has been talking about this common budget without even ever managing to do it. Even in the depth of the financial crisis or the euro sovereign crisis with Greece and threat on Spain and Portugal and Ireland, we didn't get that. So the fact that today there is for the first time a significant budget relying on common debt issuance is just super important. And it's massive from a political economy point of view. Now, when it comes to what will be the actual support to economic activity, then it's probably less significant in terms of the demand gap that we were discussing. Most of the money will not be available in 2021. It will be 2022 and 2023. So hopefully when we're trying to, you know, lift trend growth and do long-lasting investment that can help shape our economies, but it's the cliff of the risk of 2021 will not be offset by this from an economic standpoint. But I think from a political economy, and from this signal that there is a common fiscal policy, then the step is absolutely enormous and fabulous. And for the entire world stability, we should be happy.
I tend to agree with you, but I'm not being asked for my opinion here. So last question for you from me.
The one thing to say, I'm Doug and Laurence. I mean, I'm not a great predictor of the internal dynamics of European politics, but interest rates are likely to continue to be very low. Maybe the next crisis they're at zero, and the crisis after that they're at zero. And so monetary policy is just so constrained, the need for fiscal policy so much greater, that I think that's going to just keep the pressure on this issue and towards greater fiscal integration and a euro area level fiscal policy.
So, all right, let me pick up on that. I'm going to shelve the question I was going to ask and just ask, so are there, in your view, both of you, collective strategic benefits to having what could be as high as 750 billion euros of euro-denominated, presumably AAA, cross-border guaranteed, euro-denominated sovereign issuance? so that suddenly there's a common instrument outside of Italian bonds that is liquid, euro-denominated, AAA, and that plays a role in reserve portfolios. Does that actually start to chip away at the predominance of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency of choice, or is it simply one of those things we talk about every 5 or 10 years and nothing ever happens?
I mean, not to be competitive, but $750 billion is nothing compared to the $20 trillion of U.S. treasuries that the world can buy if it wants to. So I'm not worried about the dominance of the dollar as reserve currency. And I think there's might even be some benefits to reducing some of the pressure on the dollar that comes from that status. Sorry, Laurence.
No, but I can only agree with this. And I think what makes the strength of the dollar as well is to have a united country, right? We are not yet in a federal confederation for Europe. So, but it's good. Stability in Europe is good for the rest of the world. So it's still super important.
Great. All right. Well, so I'm going to turn it over to my chat function here where we've got a series of questions that have come in. I'm going to read these off the screen. So I apologize if some of them are cumbersome. It's not the way I've written them. So first question, how can the transatlantic relationship support the competitiveness of companies and industries facing a rising China? Will Europe end up being a supplier for China, or can we level the playing field in terms of trade? Laurence, the relationship of the EU and China, and presumably the US and the EU as they relate to one another vis-a-vis China.
I'm not as negative as what the question is sort of suggesting. I think Europe is also, you know, what we were saying about the dollar and what we were saying about fiscal policy is also super important for trade. And as you know, trade policy is one of the common policy of the EU. So there's an EU authority in charge of monetary policy. There's another one in charge of trade and competition policy. And I think this crisis has shown that also these two areas, pragmatism could be implemented and step forward made. Let me give you two examples. Competition, the state aid rules have been lifted so that European states were able to support their companies to different extent, but I think it did make a difference. And here as well, we will have Europe will have to reconsider, if not reboot, the competition and investment policy, and it has been started as well. Some barriers were put to make sure that investment from foreign countries was into Europe was controlled. And in terms of trade, I don't think if I can end this with a joke, I don't think we should be very scared of any trade agreement being concluded very quickly, given how long it takes to make a small step. You know, if you look at the CETA, the one with Canada, and what's happening with Brexit, so which I'm not worried about this.
Jason, thoughts on China-Europe relationship?
I would just say the United States isn't big enough to take on China all on its own. Would love to see more transatlantic pressure on our shared interests vis-a-vis China. To do that would require the United States there to change its goals. I don't think we could enlist Europe's help in pressuring China to buy more Boeing jets. We might get Europe's help in pressuring China to be more transparent about how it handles intellectual property.
Fair enough. Let me ask a question here from Tom Wright, my colleague at Brookings, but it dovetails with that cooperation aspect. Tom's asking, how would you rate international economic cooperation now, both on fiscal and monetary policy, specifically as compared to the response in 2008, 2009? Does it matter that the G20 is effectively not doing very much? Jason?
There's been a lot of correlated action, lots of countries doing similar things at similar times. Very little of it has been coordinated. I don't know that that's such a huge deal, the distinction between them. It's debt relief and debt standstills and the like for emerging markets and developing countries that I think has suffered from the lack of coordination. There's been some, but it's quite small, the debts service moratorium. So far, that's been a bit less consequential than I thought 6 months ago, in that capital started flowing back into emerging and developing countries after the terrifying rush out in the month of March. But if we go back to problems with emerging and developing countries, that's where you really do need coordination, and the convergent action isn't enough. So I'm worried about that tail risk so far. We haven't been that hurt by it, I think.
Laurence, before you answer, let me just pick up on Jason's point on the DSSI, the Debt Service Suspension Initiative, and that is the Global Low-Income Country G20 initiative to provide debt relief. There has been some press reporting that the private sector, and in particular China, have been reluctant to play as assertive a role in providing that debt relief as had been hoped for. Do you see that as being reflective of the nature of the lack of international coordination posited by the question? And I've been asked to clarify that question was not actually from Tom Wright. It was from the head of French Policy Planning. But anyway, Laurence, what do you think about those two sort of cooperation at the G20 level in terms of fiscal and monetary response, and taking it one step further on debt relief?
So on fiscal response, I agree with Jason that was, you know, correlated, not necessarily coordinated. I think the confidence signal that is sent when there is some more coordination is actually powerful in lifting up people confidence, and that has some benefits. But the fact is that the important thing was people's government actually spend the money. On the debt service relief, actually the G20 initiative means that China's part of it. So, and that's the first time. So I think it's a big success, and we should actually be happy with that. Also, it's just the first step as well. I mean, if the situation continues to deteriorate, more will probably be needed. There are a couple of things I would like to add. On monetary, central banks have always worked cooperatively, and I think we saw it again in this crisis with the swap line from advanced economy central banks to others. There are two areas so where we are crucially lacking cooperation. The one is all the trade barriers that were put in the manufacturing sector, and especially for medical protective equipment. Frankly, when you have a shortage of supply and huge demand, trying to ring fence its border is the best way to make sure that a suboptimal stock is reaching each country. So I hope that when we have a vaccine, we don't do this type of things, and we coordinate to ensure the entire planet may be vaccinated as quickly as possible. Because as long as the virus will be somewhere, we will not be able to fully function as before. And I think that that's the key thing ahead, is vaccine coordination and trade cooperation for at least, you know, medical protective equipment. That's super important.
Great, thanks. Let me ask you, are we missing a global opportunity to transition to a greener, more digital, more inclusive global economy? Is this, you know, Rahm Emanuel, the former White House Chief of Staff under President Obama, famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Are there opportunities that we collectively are missing right now, including the one posed by this question, about taking advantage of this crisis and reorienting some of our policies to favor digital, greener economies, technologies? Laurence, you're up on my screen, so I'm going to point at you.
Okay. Okay. So there are a couple of things. I think the first phase, we were really in emergency, and that was fine. But it's true that now we're, governments are setting up their recovery plans. And as far as we've seen so far, it's very difficult to even account for what's green and sustainable, to even account for, you know, prioritizing spending beyond the health necessity and focusing on education or thinking about inclusion. So it might not be for this recovery plan, but I think demand is super important. But this crisis is likely to be long, and that requires us to actually do the work that we haven't done in the previous crisis and learn the lessons from, for example, some investment that were made in renewable technology in not a very thoughtful way in the previous crisis. So all these things should be the time to think a little more about granular policy and how we want to reboot the world and to make sure that I'm going to quote a French writer when asked what he thought the world post-COVID would be. This writer is famous in France, but I don't think elsewhere, said, well, it will be the same, but a little worse. So I hope we don't do that and we manage to change things for something a little better, at least.
Jason, any comments? I'm just smiling at the same, but just a little worse.
I think the sooner we do something on climate change, the better. If it's in service of and argue that it's helping this, I don't think it's like the number one priority in responding to COVID, but it could help a bit. And, you know, they could be linked or they could be done in parallel, just like we did the Affordable Care Act at the same time we're doing the financial crisis. But either way, the sooner we deal with climate, the better.
Laurence, let me pick up. Jason, during his remarks, mentioned a potential optimal debt to GDP level in the U.S. of 150%, and you know, noted that the Maastricht Treaty has a 60% target in Europe. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. What do you think of Jason's 150 for the U.S.? And more importantly, what's the right number for Europe, knowing full well that whatever an economist, even one as prominent as yourself, suggests is likely to run into some pretty hard walls within the political economy of Europe. But what's the right number? There you go.
I don't think there is. I don't think we can find the right number. I completely agree with Jason on this. I mean, one thing is sure, you know, that Europe was able to lift the rules of the Stability and Growth Pact in this crisis. Now, obviously, the discussion ahead of us is what do you do with this fiscal framework? How do you think about it? And what I particularly liked in Jason's presentation was the way he had to drag people to think about the flows to stock analysis and what that means also in terms of what central banks are going to do. And I think, you know, one of the top priority that we have actually for the economic department at the OECD is to think about how are we going to define debt sustainability in this new world? What's the definition? What are central banks' moves changing about it? How should we look at it? So that's work ahead of us. And frankly, I don't think any honest economist today has an answer to that question.
Yeah.
That's a great work program.
And just to put one number on it, you know, when Maastricht was agreed, the 10-year borrowing rate for Germany was 8%. Now it's -0.5%. It may not stay at -0.5%. It may go all the way back up to 1%. Maybe it'll even go to 2%. But, you know, at a 2% interest rate, in some sense, you can afford 4 times more debt than you could afford at an 8% interest rate. And the difference in real interest rates actually is proportionally even larger. So you want to think about this very differently than the 60% target that was set, you know, an entire world ago, economically speaking.
One can make a very strong case that when drafting Maastricht and coming up with the euro, if someone had said in the year 2020, you'll be in a negative interest rate environment, that you would have been laughed out of the room. So clearly a rethink is probably appropriate. Jason and Laurence, it's time for final words. I'm going to ask Jason if you can give your final summing up, and then Laurence to you, and then we will conclude this year's our own lecture. Jason, a minute or two on your final thoughts.
Just would end by saying, you know, there's been a lot of commonalities in the response. There have been a lot of differences, and I think there's a lot to be learned from what other countries are doing. Some of it we can learn in real time. some of it will take more time. And that's why these types of discussions are so important, and people, you know, organizations like the OECD and people like Laurence that can go back and forth are so important, because too often we just look to, you know, the policy response in our own country when there's so much more we could learn by looking outside.
Laurence, the final words are yours, please.
That's too much. I would add that, you know, I know that everybody has said we're living in an unprecedented uncertain world, but I think it's true. And what that requires is actually a lot more humility and flexibility than we usually have. And this type of dialogue where we can exchange, at least that should be preserved and enhanced, because the situation will be evolving day by day, and we've never gone through something like that. So being a little more open and pragmatic and discussing, and we rely on you, Doug, and the Brookings to actually organize more talks to that direction.
Well, look, on behalf of Brookings, first of all, I'd like to thank Laurence and Jason, as well as Ambassador Etienne and our own Suzanne Maloney, for your remarks today. This concludes the Aron lecture. I think it was fascinating. I think it was useful. I think it was timely. Hopefully we can do it again, either in this forum or in another one soon. And to all of you watching online, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.